Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and editor Simon Lambert today is deputy editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, we got the least mini of budgets imaginable this week. Tax cuts and U-turns galore, growth being the name of the game for this new era of Conservative leadership. But with rates being raised by central banks here and across the pond, exactly to slow growth and bring down rising prices, who's right? Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at etoro.com/academy/podcasts.
But first, Prime Minister Liz Truss and Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng have been pretty busy since coming to power a few short weeks ago. A new energy price guarantee kicks in next month, and the national insurance U-turn that we got this week will come in November. But what else could possibly be included in this mini budget, we wondered? The Prime Minister's made no secret of her belief that cutting taxes and stimulating growth is the only way out of this economic mess we find ourselves in at the moment. And we got both. Sky-high spending pledges and sweeping tax cuts have investors, economists, and doubtless the Bank of England rather spooked. So, very briefly, firstly, if you would, just run down some of the main highlights, the headlines for us, and we will drill into them in a little bit more detail later on. But just what did we get, Lee? Go on, tease it up for us.
Well, I'll tell you what, as you say, we've got anything but a mini budget. I mean, what a way to bill it when, in fact, it was the biggest tax cutting budget since 1972. That doesn't feel like such a mini budget to me. I mean, it's, you think mini budget, I think of a little mouse scuttling around, not like a lion roaring with all sorts of cuts and things going on. I mean, it was absolutely bonkers. I think we've just about caught our breath here in the office after watching it this morning. 9:30, by the way. Yeah, that's a way to start the day as a financial journalist. But some of the big things, I mean, we already knew about the national insurance reversal. It was very much a kind of a reversal budget. So we had that news about the 1.25 percentage point being scrapped. We've got the reversal of things like dividend tax, corporation tax is going to be 19%, not going to 25%. These measures are going to cost quite a lot of money. Other big highlights, there was some tinkering with stamp duty, which we'll get into more detail about in a minute. And I think one that kind of surprised us all a little bit was the income tax, bringing the 90p in the pound a year early and scrapping the 45%. Rate, which again we're going to go into more detail now, and they're just the things I can squeeze in the first minute. I mean, there was a lot to unpick and a lot going on.
It was, wasn't it? I remember the last actual budget that we had with Rishi Sunak. Goodness me, that feels a long time ago. And just thinking, is that it? Whereas this one, it was all going, wasn't it, Lee? I mean, goodness me. Before we though do get into the nitty gritty there, holistically, Simon, in terms of the economic and political approach of Kwasi Kwarteng and, of course, Liz Truss there, what did you make of the speech and, when you add it all together, the measures?
We're going for growth, Georgie.
Yes.
That is the plan.
New era, Simon, new era.
A new era, going for growth. We are going to drag ourselves out of the low growth era and back into a on-trend gangbusters 2.5% a year job. The idea is that by going back to growth and growing the economy, you increase the tax base, and that means you're getting more money in, and that means that you can fund the spending that we're doing. We're doing a lot of that spending now without funding it, which is a controversial move. And I think that people, the sort of international markets view of Britain at the moment is very much a wait and see job. Just because you lower taxes and increase spending and plan to borrow to fund that gap doesn't mean that people will necessarily look down on you if they think that you are going to get something good out of that and you're doing it for constructive reasons. And also, I think the really important thing is that you have a level of stability and a plan that's going to be stuck to. I think that with reason, people may be looking at Britain from the outside at the moment and wondering if there is a plan and a plan that's going to be stuck to, because we do seem to keep coming up with different plans and having different people putting them into action. Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng have got 2 years, though, so they don't have very long. So that's why they're having to just do this whole explosive run for, you know, dash for growth right at the start. How much of a difference will these things make at the same time as they're pushing against the cost of living crisis and inflation that's sucking money out of people's pockets, and also against the Bank of England, which is at the same time as we are handing people money or giving people tax cuts, taking money off them through interest rate rises or trying to dampen borrowing? I don't know. It remains to be seen. But we'll go into the details one by one. The only thing I would say is that a penny off income tax sounds great, but for somebody on £30,000 a year, that's £391 more in their pocket. £391 more in their pocket is about £30 a month. Mm-hmm. That's not going to make a huge difference, but you do have to remember that the government has just stepped in and taken a grand off people's, the average household's energy bills as well, which again does make a big difference. You have to sort of look at all these things in a big picture. And in a big picture, I think they are giving people quite a lot of help at the moment. And the hope is that that will lead through into, you know, the economy improving. The irony is that what we actually hoped was going to get us back to an era of higher growth was the rebound from COVID, and we were going to go to the roaring 20s. The roaring 20s idea seems a long way off now, doesn't it?
Doesn't it just? Lee, let's go into then more detail this income tax cut. Actually, when you look at a lot of the measures, and we got the national insurance, three times that's going to change in 7 months or something. Poor accountants and payroll staff and everybody else that can't work out what the hell's going on. But the national insurance cut, all of these sorts of things, you know, you look at it and you say, well, it's just help for the rich, isn't it? But the reality is the more you earn, the more tax you pay, right?
Well, this is it. But this is what the kind of a bit of backlash has been in the aftermath of this announcement with income tax. So the 19p in the pound thing was mooted before, and that was allegedly going to happen in election year, and people were going to benefit from that, but they're going to benefit from that a year early. The scrapping of the 45% band is the one where, when you start looking at the figures, actually, people that are higher earners are going to have way more pounds in their pocket. Now, having a look at these figures, if you're earning £30,000, as Simon says, you're going to have £391 more a year. 174 quid of that will be income tax, and £217 of that, roughly, national insurance. You get to a tipping point at 50 grand, where actually the income tax saving is going to be more than national insurance. So 374 income tax, 362 national insurance. So overall 736 quid if you're earning that much. However, when you start going up the bands, the pay bands, it starts to look quite meaty. The tax savings look quite meaty. So on 100 grand, you're going to be £1,103 better off. On 150 grand, £1,468. And then if you're on 200 grand, £4,333. And then 300 grand, £10,000. I mean, that's quite a massive jump up. Now, there's not that many people in the country that earn that much money. And the argument will be, especially from the opposition, that more should have been done for middle and low income earners and putting more money in their pocket in a cost of living crisis. And that's what a lot of the backlash has come. And of course, when we heard the opposition then talking about things like bankers' bonuses, and you start adding that all up, and you can see where there was a little bit of backlash and concern about these measures, because these measures are going to cost billions of pounds to implement. So, you know, it's a difficult balance, but anything I guess that puts pounds back in people's pockets is a good thing.
Thank you very much for that, Lee. Simon, the knock-on impact of this elsewhere, I remember when Rishi Sunak first announced the cut to the basic rate of income tax to be brought in later on, obviously, and I thought a lot about pensions and the pension relief you'll get. What impact is it going to have on that, on child benefits, student loans, all sorts of things?
Well, it will unfortunately make it harder to explain pension tax relief to people, because pension tax relief means that for a basic rate taxpayer, the money that you put in, you get a 25% uplift on to take you back to where you were before you paid basic rate tax, which is always slightly confusing for people because they say, well, I paid 20% tax. And you say, ah, but if you have £100 and you take £20 off it, you have 80. So to go back from 80 to 100, you have to add a quarter back to the 80, which is 25%. £20 on 80 takes you back up to 100. It's not going to be dealing with round numbers anymore. So it's going to be much harder to explain, unfortunately. People with things that people find hard to understand, it's much better if you can explain it with round numbers. Ultimately, the principle stays the same. You'll save out of untaxed earnings. I think the real issue with the income tax cuts, from my personal point of view, is that I actually have no problem with removing the 45p rate of tax. Mm-hmm. Okay. Perfectly happy with a scenario where our highest rate of tax is 40p. Apart from the fact that the highest rate of income tax is not 40p. Our highest marginal rate of income tax is in fact 60p, because we removed the personal allowance from people above £100,000. And the personal allowance is £12,500 roughly. It's a little bit more than that. But let's deal with round numbers for reasons I just explained. So for every extra pound that you earn, you lose 50p of your personal allowance until it's all gone, from 100 to roughly £123,000. And that means that it adds effectively 50% to your tax rate. So instead of paying 40% tax on the next pound that you earn, you pay 60% tax on the next pound you earn. And I've always thought that it's slightly crazy that we have this scenario introduced by George Osborne, where the £100,000 figure has never risen. There's a massive amount of fiscal drag going on there. And people end up paying 60% tax, and then it drops back down to 40%, and then it goes back up to 45% at £150,000. And I think it's unforgivable to remove a 45% tax rate for people further up the scale and retain an effective 60% tax rate for people lower down. Okay. Now, it's very difficult to elicit any sympathy for these people hit by this, but it is a massive anomaly in our tax system. And you've got to remember that you want people to be encouraged to pay tax and feel they're being treated fairly. And if you treat people unfairly on their way up into being very high earners, you're in the top decile at that point, you're probably going to continue earning more, and your attitude towards paying tax is going to be coloured probably for the rest of your earning career, because like, well, I wasn't treated very fairly then, so you know what, why, what, I am going to take advantage of everything I possibly can moving forwards. Then you also have another scenario where people pay a much higher rate of tax lower down the scale, which is the removal of the child benefit that you get for people between £50,000 and £60,000. Again, that threshold has never moved, hasn't moved up with wages, hasn't moved up with inflation. If you've got one child, the effective tax rate from the removal of child benefit on the next pound you earn is 51%. So you're actually paying 51% tax. If you've got two children, you're paying 59% tax, right? It's not right to bring down the marginal tax rate for people on 150, 250, 500,000, £1 million a year, and retain those anomalies much further down the tax system. And the only other thing I would say is, fine, get rid of the 45p tax rate, but move that higher rate tax band up much further from £50,000, which it did have a jump up to the 50, but it hasn't kept pace with wages, it hasn't kept pace with inflation, and it should arguably be much higher. And I think that's all part of creating a tax system that feels fair. And so you don't end up with the scenario that you've got today, where the Chancellor has come out and cut income tax, which generally seems a very good thing, and all of a sudden you get a really big backlash.
Yeah. I sense, Lee Boyce, that not that these haven't been well thought out, but I don't imagine they've been given the same amount of detail that your good selves have been thinking over this and other experts in these fields. I don't know. I mean, but they haven't really been in there long. It seems a lot of headline grabbers in this. What do you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, I must admit, I mean, a couple of these things I don't think any of us were quite expecting. I think there has been a couple of things that feel quite big. I mean, I would have thought that there has been enough thought put into it in the fact that during the Conservative leadership contest, Liz Truss was in and around, you know, the favourites from the start. And I think it'd be foolish that if she wasn't thinking about the cost of living crisis, and potentially if she became Prime Minister, delivering a more of a Conservative budget than what we have seen in recent years. Okay, it wasn't actually a full-blown budget, but it felt like one.
Yeah.
And I think that she was going to her values, which she was kind of vocal from the start, which was to cut a number of taxes. And that's why we have seen the biggest tax cut since 1972.
Not that, yeah, absolutely rightly. Not that I'm suggesting that these ideas weren't part of a wider political philosophy that she might have and they've been thought through. It's more the fact that there are a lot of nitty gritty detail, like Simon was pointing out, a lot of anomalies in the act of, you know, cutting the higher rate. Actually, there's other things you need to sort of take a look at a little bit beneath the surface.
Well, maybe scrapping the Office of Tax Simplification was a bit not a wise move, as revealed in this budget, because, you know, if tax is this complicated, which it is, there's so many little things that have been added and taken away over the years, over the decades. It's complicated, and it's very complicated, especially, as you say, with the different elements of people's lives. You know, it could be difficult, baffling to work out.
Absolutely, Lee. I mean, we've got the third change coming to our national insurance, as I mentioned. We didn't actually get that in the mini budget. We got it the day before. I'm lost with it all, Lee.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when we were talking about this earlier in the year, and then the changes that came in, it was just so convoluted and complicated, and now we've just come further down the line. It's almost part of me that just thought the budget earlier in the year we could have just done without it in the end, because it's got complicated. But yeah, you're right.
But they gave 3 months, didn't they? So they made the change in April, and then they said they'd bring in the next change, which was increasing the rate at which you start paying national insurance, but in June or July, I think, to give payroll and everything a couple of months now, 3 months notice. And now they seem to sort of, and it doesn't matter now, do payroll not need notice before they bring it back down to where it was?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot
of people. We'll find out.
There's a lot of people scratching their heads around it. I'm thinking, oh, not another national insurance change, for goodness sake.
But what's going to happen to health and social care?
Well, it's still going to have the same budget, apparently, that was going to be from these NI hikes. But where it's coming from,
it's 13 billion, isn't it? That's just now got to be found down the back of the sofa.
And ballooning and growing. If you read into it, you know, because our population is getting more elderly, you know, NHS is under pressure. You know, it is one of those things. There is a massive funding gap. And the cost of all of this is what's spooking investors and markets. And it's a lot of money that is being thrown around along with tax cuts. It's the devil would be in the detail, but we don't have a lot of the detail of the costings and where's what's, you know, going to be paying for social care, for example, massive problem that we have in this country.
There was a problem with the health and social care levy, which is that it comes from national insurance, and which was criticised as a tax on jobs, because it would be not only be paid by employees, it'd be paid by employers. But the people it wouldn't be paid by is pensioners who pay tax, but they don't pay national insurance. And there is an argument that if we're going to pay for health and social care largely falling upon the more elderly members of society, and the health falling on them more as well, that we should be spreading that across everybody, not just the people of who are employed, basically.
Absolutely. Simon, we're going to talk about now stamp duty, because this is something you were looking at actually earlier on in the week in your article. And I have to say, when I heard the idea of stamp duty cut, it did send shivers down my first time buyer spine, given how much fuel it added to the fire of ridiculous house prices over the last couple of years. But you made a very good point. It's a rubbish tax. It stops people economically and psychologically moving, clogging up the system. but it is only going to work if it's permanent. So what did we get with regards to stamp duty?
We got something permanent.
Hey! That, well, permanent for the next 2 years, no?
That is the good thing about the stamp duty move today. And actually, that a lot of the criticism of the stamp duty holiday and a lot of the distorting effects of the stamp duty holiday, which could save people up to £15,000, quite a lot of money, if they were buying a home costing more than £500,000, because it was exempt up to £500,000, and the rate of stamp duty above £250,000 is 5%. The distortion comes from the temporary nature of it. People rush to buy before it runs out. If you bring in something permanently, you remove that rush. You might still get some of it, arguably, if you suddenly cut tax by so much.
2 years, though, Simon. That, I mean, who's to say whoever comes in next isn't going to change this?
Well, I think, who knows, but anything could happen in 2 years, and maybe they won't.
That's
and
they're
true. Quite unpopular. And also, the other thing is that I don't really think it makes much difference. So I wrote yesterday that, yeah, my first thoughts when I saw reports emerge this week of a potential stamp duty cut were, what? Why? I mean, we're still reeling from the last holiday. House price inflation is in double digits. The Bank of England, in case anybody hadn't noticed, is hiking interest rates at a rapid clip, a lot of which is directed at increasing the cost of mortgages, lowering demand for borrowing, and so on and so on. And so what we're going to do is we're going to bung people money in the other direction. But then, you know, as you said, I wrote, maybe it's always a good time to get rid of a bad tax. And the reason why stamp duty is a bad tax is actually because for most people, it's not a massive problem. It's an annoyance of a few thousand pounds. But once you start to go further up the scale, it starts to become very expensive. And you find yourself paying £10,000 or tens of thousands of pounds in stamp duty. And that's where it starts to stop people making the decision to move and starts to really hamper people. What we had today was a lifting of the threshold at which people start paying stamp duty. So instead of starting at £125,000, it's going to start at £250,000. But that's only going to save people a maximum of £2,500 because there is a 2% rate up to £250,000, at which point the 5% rate kicks in. Now, initially, when people were talking about what might happen, there was the thought that they might just shove the whole thing up. So basically, you raise the threshold and then you still start the tax rates at 2%, but it's 2% from 250 up to 925 and then 5% from 925 above, except they haven't done that. They've done zero up to 250 and then 5% above that, which means that you're only saving that £2,500. Now, I would argue that £2,500 in your pocket is always good. Doesn't shift the dial, though, on making a decision as to whether you are going to move home and really reduce the hurdle or lower the hurdle to you know, not mix my metaphors or whatever, in terms of what stamp duty does to people. So I actually think that they've missed a golden opportunity here.
What was the point then? Just headline?
I think, I don't know. And this is what I wrote in my column is so many times we've had this sort of attempt to overhaul stamp duty, but people have pulled back from the bad headlines you get, because ultimately the people who benefit the most are the people buying the most expensive houses and they tend to be richer. But I genuinely think that this is an area where some trickle-down economics does work. You want the people at the top of the ladder to be moving because they're going to sell their home to someone slightly further down, who sells to someone slightly further down, to someone slightly further down. It's called a property ladder for a reason. And one of the things that gums up the property ladder is the difficulty of people being able to get their hands on those family homes. And those larger detached family homes are the ones where a lot of the inflation has come from in recent years. It's the ones where the estate agents tell you they just don't have enough stock. People end up in bidding wars and overpaying and stuff like that. If you can get more people moving, then you get more supply into the market, you make it a bit more liquid. That doesn't necessarily mean that prices have to go up. especially if at the same time you've got the Bank of England making mortgage rates more expensive. It, ideally, a scenario where the hurdle to buying a house in terms of monetary lump sum, i.e. the deposit you have to put down and the stamp duty you have to pay, is lower, but mortgage rates are higher, but house prices, a lid is kept on them, is arguably better than the one that we've had in recent years, where cheap mortgages and borrowing mean house prices just keep going ever and ever higher, which means that you then have to find an even larger lump sum to get that deposit. The good news is, for first-time buyers, their exemption has gone up from £300,000 to £425,000, and the maximum price of property that you can buy in order to get that relief has gone up to £625,000. So you won't get it on the 625, you only get it on 425, but you can buy a property that costs up to 625 to get it. And that's good news, because it, for first time buyers, the saving, the potential saving is actually greater than it is for home movers. So actually first time buyers are getting a better deal here, and a first time buyer could save a maximum of £6,250, but they'd have to be a first time buyer buying a seriously expensive property for a first time buyer.
Yeah. Lee, you were sort of smiling along at that at times. What was going through your head?
Yeah, well, I was thinking, if you're going to save £2,500, especially if you're in the home buying process at the moment, I mean, that pays for your energy bills for the year. So, I mean, you'd be pretty happy with that, yeah, if you're in the process. And if not, you know, you might be spending that, putting that into the economy by, you know, maybe doing, bringing forward a renovation for your new home that you might be putting off because you don't have the cash. Because stamp duty is just dead money. It really is dead money. And it's put me off moving, no doubt. I look at the figures involved and I think, oh, I don't know, it just feels like such a dead tax that sort of goes nowhere. And I think that raising it for first-time buyers is good news. Obviously, the last stamp duty, the holiday, I mean, that just absolutely lit a fire under house prices. I mean, you know, it's just absolutely crazy when that happened. And as Simon says, rushing purchases through, thinking, you know, I could save 15 grand here. I mean, that got into a lot of people's minds and they just went for it. Yeah. This is different. And we've had a lot of commentary come through from, you know, the usual suspects in the industry, you know, basically talking it all up again and whatnot. But I don't think it's going to have near the same effect. This is £2,500 saving, basically no matter what value of home you're going to buy. So especially if you're someone that's buying, you know, somewhere around the 300 grand mark, yeah, you know, typical price, it's really good news. I mean, you go further up the ladder, £1 million house, you're still saving just that same £2,500.
Oh, it's better than poking the eye with a stick and all that sort of thing.
Exactly. I do wish though that it just, the stamp duty thing is just a real, it's just a real horror show. The last 15 years or so of it and all the tinkering, all the mucking around with it, and it's just, yeah, it's incredible. And I think they've thrown it into this mini large budget. You know, and you're right, it has a good feel to it. People, you know, care about property and all of that kind of stuff, so it has that little sort of George Osborne magic effect, I would argue.
Rabbits out of the hat. Simon?
The only other thing I would say about stamp duty is that, firstly, I think considering the amount of fuss made about this and the fact that they came in for so much criticism that about cutting stamp duty off the back of the holiday and everything like that, they bottled it. I think that this was the best opportunity we had to see proper reform of the stamp duty system in many, many years. Because I think that they could have quite easily brazened out the criticism of you just helping rich people, because they're like taking out the 45p tax rate for a start. So, you know, they're getting the criticism for that anyway. So I think it's a real shame that they didn't properly do something about stamp duty. And I think on Lee's point there, the £15,000 element, you know, that maximum saving above 500 grand, 500 grand is a huge amount of money to spend on a house, unless you live in quite a sizable chunk of the country in which you're basically just buying a bog standard family home, right? The amount of people I know who decided that they would move to take advantage of that, probably false economy, because unless you got in right at the start, you just paid more for the house anyway. But the amount of people and the data that we've seen and the transactions and how it did light a fire and stuff demonstrates to me why the really high stamp duty we have is a real problem. You can argue people have a set budget and they have their deposit and they have their stamp duty and have their mortgage costs and everything like that, and they just work to that budget. But that 15 grand thing and how powerful it was demonstrates to me why we should do something about this scenario. And you know what? Until Gordon Brown started meddling with it in 1997, this country survived perfectly well with a flat rate of stamp duty of 1%. And that was on properties costing more than £60,000. And at the point when he started meddling, the average property cost £58,000. So the equivalent today would be no stamp duty up to £270,000, and then you just pay 1% on top. And if we survived with that in the past, I do not understand why we could not survive with it now.
Lee, just a very quick one on some of the other areas that we got that will create a few talking points. Alcohol, help for businesses, bankers, bonuses, corporation tax, anything?
Well, it's like a top of the pot rundown of stuff that's going on. I mean, the alcohol tax one, again, is just one of those ones that people sort of see it and they say, oh, slightly cheaper beer, hooray. And then we think, well, actually, if you go out to a pub now, it's about £7 a pint. Probably going to keep rising as, you know, businesses struggle with rising energy bills despite the packages that have been announced. That's a classic one. That the corporation tax thing is going to be a big talking point, I would suggest, over the coming days. That's, you know, one of the lowest in the G7, and I think that, you know, the argument is that it stimulates the economy by having more businesses that want to get involved and be here. For one. And then the bankers' bonuses thing, I kind of get the argument. I'll be totally frank with you. And I can see the argument of why this has been lifted, as in London has always been known as one of the finance capitals of the world, if not the finance capital of the world, but it's close run thing. You know, you've got New York, you've got Hong Kong. What's happening, and the argument from the Chancellor, is that there's been a drain of talent potentially, and difficulty creating jobs in the sector, especially high level jobs, because you could potentially earn bigger bonuses in other cities and pay less tax. So his argument is, let's lift the cap. People that are earning these big bonuses were just, what was happening is that they were just getting bigger salaries. So really it didn't kind of do much. And there's a lot of cultures, there's a lot of countries in the world that are used and staff are used to getting bonuses, you know, and that's the thing. But again, you can see when that's mentioned fairly early on in a mini budget, why that might rile certain people. And, you know, again, I've seen some backlash over the whole bankers bonuses thing. I don't know. For me, it's not one of the be-all, end-all, most important things that are pressing this country at the moment. Anything that's creating jobs and attracting top talent, in my mind, banks can afford it. It's up to them. I think what people don't want and what they associate it with is the reckless banking of 2000, leading up to 2007, 2008 and the financial crisis. That's what people have in their minds. That's what people think about. Is that fair? Well, it's hard for me to judge, really.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Sam Northby-Toro for our weekly look at what's been happening on the markets. Sam, bit of a quiet one, really. Not much happened over the past week, did it?
Yeah, not much. Yeah, really quiet. I mean, this won't take too long. Even look, for those that were hoping for a positive week, it couldn't really have gone much worse. You know, we've seen stock markets reach multi-year lows, currencies like our very own pound hit a 35-year low, and generally most asset classes have come under significant pressure. Federal Reserve obviously raised rates by 75 basis points, but were a touch more hawkish in their speech and from what the market expected. And the Bank of England raised rates by 50 basis points, but with the mix of voting from the MPC, it kind of showed that collectively they didn't really know what to do. The markets look like they're going to finish near their lows, and there doesn't seem to be too much positive news out there. The mini budget, which might have been a good thing, hasn't really looked like that. The pound, gilt and the FTSE have not taken too kindly to it, and are all trading considerably lower. Thank God it's Friday and we don't have to look at markets for a couple of days.
So the dust is going to settle over the weekend, and then we're going to look ahead to next week. Do you think that a lot of eyes over next week and in the coming weeks are going to be on the currency markets?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the pound for sure. It'd be interesting to see how the weekend news takes what we've heard today. And also from the euro, you've got the Italian election. So that could potentially move things come on Monday. And you've got a lot of European data out from Germany. And obviously Germany being the top economy within Europe, their data moves the euro. So currency wise, that's massive. And the main thing that's moving all markets at the moment, the US dollar just continues to be rampant, and that's affecting a lot of things. So yeah, eyes very much on the currency space. Next week is the last week of the month and the quarter. Seasonally, September's a pretty bad month. And while you've got to take these things with a pinch of salt, that's been the case again. Potential for a little bit of rebalancing into the back end of the quarter. So traders, investors need to be a little bit aware of that. From the US data-wise, final GDP reading, because it's a final reading, not expecting too much. We do have another inflationary point, so we'll keep a watch on that for next Friday. But I think everyone just wants to see the back of this month now.
Well, I'll look forward to speaking to you in a week's time when everything will have calmed down and we'll all be back to normal.
So, fingers crossed.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks, Simon.
Welcome back. Right, before we start talking about the Bank of England voting to raise interest rates, Simon, what's been the immediate reaction to the budget, to gilts and to sterling? And what does it all mean?
We've seen a scenario where there's been a what would be described as a sell-off in UK gilts over recent weeks, month, and also the pound. The pound has been falling against the dollar. It continued to fall yesterday after the Bank of England decision, because it only cut by 0.5% rather than 0.75%. And we've seen UK government borrowing costs, which gilts are the name for UK government bonds. Again, the cost of our borrowing is rising today. Yields are going up, prices are falling, prices and yields move in the opposite direction to each other. So for example, 10-year gilts are now trading at 3.8%. On the 5-year gilt, that's about 4%, and that's moved up by about 50 basis points today. What that says is that markets are not entirely convinced by what's going on, but also that they see that we are going to have to do an awful lot more borrowing. And if we're going to have to do an awful lot more borrowing, that means that the supply of UK government bonds is going to rise dramatically, and that there might be too much supply and not enough demand for them. Therefore, the rates being offered on those bonds are going to have to go higher, which means that bonds that already exist, people, the price of them is falling, and the rates are going up correspondingly, because people don't want to buy old bonds that pay lower coupons. Does that make sense, my explanation of the government bond market?
It does, yeah. So yeah. What?
Well, I mean, these things swing around, and part of this is to do with how much the US is raising interest rates, and this is putting the squeeze on quite a lot of other countries. Actually, it's not just us. There is chaos in the currency markets. I mean, Japan had to step in as well this week to protect the yen, because with the US raising rates so rapidly, other countries that don't keep pace or aren't seen to be keeping pace become a less attractive place for people to put their money. And also the problem is that as rates go higher, and the rate that you can get from those government bonds, which is considered a risk-free return. Essentially, nobody expects the US to go bust. So if you buy US bonds, that's considered risk-free. It starts to look quite attractive. And once you start to get 4% from a risk-free bond, then you go, okay, well, I might as well just stick my money in there and ride out the storm. I'm not even going to invest in the stock market. And this is big, huge waves of institutional money that moves around the world. And UK gilts are also seen as a, you know, risk-free rate of return. But people say, well, I don't want yours if I can have those ones from the US that pay me a higher rate of interest. And that in turn drives up our borrowing costs, which in turn pushes down the pound, which in turn leads potentially to the Bank of England having to hike interest rates by even more. I mean, the ideal scenario is that the US, for everyone, is that the US stops raising interest rates.
Yeah, is that going to happen?
Maybe. The Fed wants to make it really, really, really clear that it's really, really, really serious about inflation.
Yeah, we get it.
And there was some hope that inflation had turned a corner and it was just going to stop. And then it made it clear, really, really, really clear last month that was really, really, really not going to happen. I mean, whether you really, really, really believe that, I don't know. And if we started to get some consistently good inflation data from the US, maybe they would pause, or it looks like, you know, a proper recession kind of thing kicking in. But actually, the US economy is still quite strong, and the inflation that they're getting isn't quite the same as the inflation that we're getting, because it's not necessarily driven by energy in the same way. So there is a greater argument for the Fed to be raising interest rates to combat their inflation than there is, for example, for the Bank of England to be raising interest rates to combat inflation that comes from international gas prices, which raising interest rates in the UK has very little impact on.
And yet, Lee Boyce, we're getting interest rate rises. We were trying to decide last week, would it be 0.75 percentage points? Would it be 0.5? And it was 0.5. Taking rate of borrowing to 2.25%, the highest since the financial crash. So what does it mean for savers, for borrowers alike? And isn't this all, Lee, a little bit, it feels very much at odds with what the government is trying to do. How is this going to balance out?
Oh, that's $1 million question. Well, first of all, the vote was 5-4. So three wanted to go at 0.75, one other wanted 0.25. We got 0.5 percentage points. We've come out today and there's talks now that markets are pricing in a 1 percentage point rise next month. Whether that happens or not, we'll wait and see. The idea is to raise rates to combat inflation, and that's the path that the Bank of England is going down. And actually, the Bank of England was mentioned a couple of times in the mini budget today, and that the Chancellor, you know, is in discussions with them, but is keeping them as an independent entity, and, you know, is making that pretty clear. But what it does for homeowners and mortgages is it's making mortgages more expensive. Now, the majority of people are on fixed rates. Let's make that clear. I think something like 75% at least of homeowners are on fixed rate mortgages. Now, what happens, as we've discussed on this podcast in the past, if you're coming off the back of a 2-year fix or a 5-year fix at ultra low rates, you know, in some instances 1%, and now we're starting to see 3.5-4%, and that's before the rate rise this week, and that's before potential rate rises before the end of the year, it's quite clear that mortgage rates at the moment are only going one way, and that is adding potentially quite a substantial amount onto your monthly mortgage costs. Now, the other thing at play here has been rising house prices. So for some people that are in that scenario, they might have seen their equity in their house grow and they might qualify for a better LTV. But even still, it is very likely that you will be paying more each month for your mortgage once you come off the end of a fix. And that's, you know, a worry for people in a cost of living crisis. The last thing people potentially want is their mortgage rate to be going higher and for it to be a high monthly outlay. But lots of people will say, well, we've had ultra low interest rates for a very long time, and people have got used to paying such little for borrowing. And that's the thing. And again, we've had this conversation on the podcast before about people talking about double-digit mortgage rates. You know, will that happen in the next couple of years? Well, it's just impossible to predict at the moment. I've got no idea. You know, all you can say is that mortgage rates are going up. And the flip side of that, though, savers are finally seeing some rates of return that look pretty substantial. We had a bit of an exciting time yesterday in the office, Georgie, when 4% came out, 4% savings rate. That's the first time we have seen 4%, well, before 10 years ago, 2012, maybe even before that. It's been a long time since you've been able to get 4% on your savings. 4% over 2 years, looking good. But the sting in the tail of that, of course, is that inflation is at 9.9%. So effectively, you are still losing money. And that's the trade-off. But at least we are seeing savings rates going the right way. It's again being driven largely by challenger banks and smaller banks. There's a couple of bigger banks that have got a little bit more involved, but still a lot of them pay quite rubbish rates. So you have to now really take stock of what your savings are doing, because there are better deals out there to switch to. Even if you switch to the best easy access now, it's paying above 2%. You know, that's better than the 0.1s and 0.2s, 0.3s that are on offer from the big banks. So we're finally starting to see some upward movement in terms of savings rates. The big question is, will they continue to rise over the next 6 months and you know, alongside potential interest rate rises? I mean, in theory, you'd think so. But, you know, it's kind of hard to predict what's going to happen to inflation at the moment, especially with the new energy package. And once that's all factored in, it's going to be a colourful and interesting next 6 months, I'd say, Georgie.
And slightly beyond as well. Simon, how do you think all this is going to play out in reality, this battle of economic theory, I guess?
Do you know what we're doing at the moment? It feels like we're driving like a racing driver. Now, I don't mean fast, and I don't mean round in circles either. What I mean is that quite a few racing drivers will drive with one foot on the accelerator and one foot on the brake, right? So instead of using the same foot for the accelerator and the brake, they just drive two pedals, okay? Unfortunately, we don't seem to necessarily have the same person driving the car. So we've got one person driving. It's more like we've got a car with, you know, those cars that people do driving lessons in, where they've got dual controls, right? But instead of dual controls, what we've got is just one. On one side, we've got someone with the accelerator, and on the other side, we've got someone with the brake. It would probably be better if those people, if we just had the one person, you know, doing it. I think this analogy is now running out of steam.
That's fine. We get the point, maybe.
This analogy to take us into the modern realm of car driving, this analogy has range anxiety and is going to stop now. I think it was interesting that the Chancellor came out and said that the Bank of England's independence was sacrosanct. Haven't had to listen to somebody say that much
very early on
the last couple of decades. They have to seem to be pulling together. It has to be seen that they're working in tandem to do this. And I think it needs to be explained to people why one's doing one thing or one's doing the other. And now that they've done all of these measures, and also on the other hand, we've got the Bank of England raising interest rates, the challenge now is getting that message through to people loud, clear, and simple. This is the plan. This is what we're doing. This is why we're doing it. This is why you can have confidence in it. And we're not going to suddenly change the plan in 3 months' time.
Right, that's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest Breaking Money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team, anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past and join in the debate in reader comments.
Marvellous. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at eToro.com/academy/podcasts.